Kreisky-Forum Talks, der Podcast zur Stunde.
So, herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren. Mein Name ist Gerald Bast, ich bin der Rektor der Universität für angewandte Kunst. Alle reden von zunehmender Komplexität, alle reden davon, dass alles mit allem irgendwie und immer mehr zusammenhängt. Und wir, als eine der wenigen Universitäten, muss ich leider sagen, leisten in diesem Sinn Pionierarbeit seit einigen Jahren. Und ich freue mich, dass heute so viel gekommen ist und wir haben diese Arbeit auf eine neue Basis gestellt. Some months, some weeks ago, we decided to make a collaboration with two strong partners, because we all know that you only are strong and effective if you have strong partners. And these partners are the Bruno Kreisky Forum for International Dialogue and the Institute for Human Sciences. And I'm very grateful to have these partners, and together in the future we will organize, hosted by a wonderful person, well known in Austria and maybe beyond, Philipp Blom, who will host the dialogues for the future. Today we will, in this setting, have the first dialogue, and he will introduce his partner later on. But first I will hand over the microphone to Misha Glenny from the Institute for Human Sciences. Thank you once more, Misha, for collaborating in this wonderful room, and I hope we will have in the future more of these wonderful situations.
Gerald, very much. My name is Misha Glenny. As Gerald said, I am the rector of the Institute for Human Sciences here in Vienna. I am particularly pleased that we have managed to put this together, partly because I strongly believe in cooperation between institutions here in this city, and partly because our first guest is Nina Khrushcheva, who, as you will find out, is an absolutely fantastic interlocutor, a great writer. I promised I wouldn't mention people by name, just the institutions, the University of Applied Art and the AIL, the Applied Interdisciplinary Lab, and the Bruno Kreisky Forum, of course, but I had to mention Nina, and equally, like Gerald, I had to mention Philipp Blom, because although there are three institutions organizing this, there is a fourth institution, which is Philipp Blom himself. He is an institution. And one which I think Vienna can be proud of. But let me just say that we want to build on this evening with future events of a similar kind. We hope you'll all come along to those as well, and we promise you we will find the most interesting speakers that we can in Europe and beyond. And with that, I would like to hand over to Gertraud, who is going to introduce the Bruno Kreisky Forum.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming tonight. I would not mention people in person, but I would like to thank the great teams that are behind the institutions. The team of the AI Lab, the team of the Institute for Human Sciences, and of course also my team, which is the best team in the world. So, thank you. I have to mention two people. Allow me to thank from the bottom of my heart Christian and Ingrid Reda, who are a wonderful couple and who are supporting Dialogues for Tomorrow, and I am very, very, very grateful. On this note, Philip, it's all yours.
Good evening. It is an enormous pleasure to welcome you here to the first of the dialogues of tomorrow. Let us talk about Russia, a society in meltdown, and let us talk about what has led to this point and perhaps what can come from it. We have all spoken about Ukraine a lot, and for those of you, and there have been some people who thought this might be a pro-Russian manifestation, let me say both Nina Khrushcheva and I have gone on public record and said about this conflict what we think about it, and that is pretty clear. But it is crucially important, first of all, to understand what has happened in this society, what has led to that, but also what these structures mean for the future, for a future Russia, because a simple look at the map suffices to see that a destabilized, humiliated, and isolated Russia for decades is not a good idea for anybody. So we will have to talk about the past, we will have to talk about the future, and we will also try to talk about, we talk about the present, we will also try to talk about the future. And where better to do this than here in this hall? And I must say, I'm especially thrilled and proud that we can sit here, because you all know the history of this building. This, what you see here, this stunningly modern architecture, comes from around 1900. And it was a building that was really a lighthouse building, looking into the future, looking away from the past and thinking about possible futures. And that's exactly what we want to do with the dialogues for tomorrow. Next time, by the way, on the 10th of May, with Natalia Tocci, an Italian political scientist, and we will talk about a political and ecological future in Europe. That'll be on the 10th of May, the second of the talks in this row. But now to this evening and to my wonderful and learned guest, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
Nina is a professor for international relations at the New School in New York. She herself describes herself somewhat modestly, if I may say so, as a professor of bullshit. That has a lot to do with the fact that she looks at propaganda, and if you professionally study propaganda, I suppose you are a professor of bullshit. Nina has written widely on Russia, on modern Russia. She is at the moment preparing a biography of Nikita Khrushchev, who also happens to have been her great-grandfather. But her first book was on Nabokov, and that shows you that there is a great cultural range and depth to these observations. Nina, welcome and thank you for being our first guest.
Thank you.
Tell me, before we go into all the political considerations, into the historical considerations, you were working on this biography, and that meant that you've spent a good part of last year in Moscow.
Yes, I did.
Tell me about that experience. Tell me what happened and what changed in Russia and in Moscow in the course of this year when you were there.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everybody, for inviting me. It's a great honor, and I'm very humbled to be the first one to open the series. I also want to address, if there are any Ukrainian people in the audience, I do want to say that many of us feel horrible and very apologetic for what my country is doing to your country. I know that mea culpa, you've heard it many times, it doesn't change anything, but I think it is important to say that. And also, I do understand that the heartache of the Russian society cannot be possibly compared to what Ukraine is going through. And yet, to answer your question, there is a heartache in the Russian society. I entered Russia. I was there for a year and a half writing the book. I left Moscow to teach in New York at the New School in January, a month before the
war, or as it is called in Russia, special military operation began. Until 30 minutes before Putin announced it, I argued that it cannot happen. I argued that it cannot happen because it was going against every single national interest, not the Kremlin interest, the national interest that that Russia had. And Putin, with everything he has done or has been done under him in 22 years of him being in power, seemed a gambler, but a careful gambler. He would not bite more than he could chew. And the idea that he would decide to go on all of Ukraine, because even I knew, and I thought, if I knew that, how could his people, or he himself wouldn't know it? Because what I learned from writing Khrushchev's biography is that he was in charge of the Communist Party of Ukraine before the war, before World War II, after World War II, that Ukrainians are going to fight like hell. They are not going to give up. And I remember there was a conversation a few months after it began saying, well, you're surprised that Ukrainians are so tough and so not giving up. It's like, no, I didn't. That's the first thing I said, that that Russians wouldn't have a prayer. So Russians didn't have a prayer. I decided to go back after teaching a semester because I wanted to see what it is there instead of just reading the New York Times of what it is there. I wanted to witness that because people go to places where things change for the better. They go to wars because that's where the action is. They don't go to the dying societies because they're dying societies. What are you going to find out there? So I went there to see sort of the end of that Russian history, the end of Russian history of 30 years when Mikhail Gorbachev said, it's a free country, do whatever you want to do. That's how, in fact, I ended up in the United States. I wasn't an immigrant. I just went as an expat. I wanted to study in America, and so I did. So I wanted to see what it is when history unravels back. And I drove on a bus from Helsinki into St. Petersburg. It was an absolutely red sunset, and it really felt like I was getting into the end of the world environment. It was just absolutely as if the world is going to end tomorrow, and that's how I entered that Russia. I was walking around the next day in St. Petersburg, and everything seemed as if nothing happens. There was a pivot to Asia, as Putin said. We have nothing to do with Europe. We're just going to look a different direction. Every restaurant was Julius Melnik Cafe, the Rome pizza, the Roman pizza, the Brussels fried French fries, or the Brussels fries. There were street artists who were, instead of painting Xi Jinping, they were actually painting Angelina Jolie and George Clooney. And so it really felt like even if the government said, that's what we're doing and we're turning away. And this is, by the way, St. Petersburg, a window into the West, which is an imitation, a grandiose imitation of Amsterdam, Venice, and other places. And I thought, well, the people didn't get the message. Like, clearly, they just did not get the message. But then you start listening to conversations, and every conversation is about the war. Everybody talks about sanctions, war, how horrible it is. No, we were forced to do it. No, Putin needs to go, and all different conversations, just about that. And then September 21st, partial mobilization, and I witnessed once again the most amazing thing. Then my building, where I live in Moscow, suddenly my phone started lighting up and saying, "This bastard's on the seventh floor. This bastard's on the eighth floor. This bastard's on the second floor. Don't open the door."
The recruiters.
Don't open the door. So people were warning each other that that's happening. And you could hear that those who don't have boys in the family, they would run out and start screaming at the recruiters, saying, "What are you doing? Who needs this war? This is ridiculous. Why can't we just live normal life? And what did the Ukrainians do to you?" And it was very brave because, you know, God knows, you can be arrested for, or very brave, I mean, once again, comparing to Ukrainians, nothing is very brave, but it was brave. in that environment. And then the woman who was a social liaison, she was complaining to me. She said, well, they were so horrible. I was like, what did you expect? And what you bring, you take these people to war. And then you noticed how, you know, with all the declarations on TV that 99.5% of the population support the special military operation. And then on the other side of TV, which you actually don't see, but you know it's happening because you go on the internet or people talk about it, there are all these lines on the road to Kazakhstan, on the road to Georgia, on any bordering country trying to escape the 99.5 support of that war. And I would calculate that about 1.5 to 2 million people left, so it cannot possibly be 99.5 because 2% already, if not more, has gone. And so what I saw is the society in complete and utter despair. Society that doesn't its dialogue for tomorrow, that absolutely doesn't see any future for itself, and just basically trying to comprehend what happened to them.
I mean, this is, I think, very important because I think we all live behind a screen of propaganda. In our Western countries, certainly more benevolent and more porous than in a totalitarian regime, but of course everything we hear is colored by a perception, colored perhaps also by a will. We do not get much unfiltered information, and we have, many of us, many people in the West have the impression that support for the war in Russia is either very high or most people just couldn't give a damn and live their lives and have a total lack of empathy. But what did you perceive in that society? How did they deal with that change?
Well, I mean, yes, they do give the numbers of 75%. I mean, I didn't do my own polling. I went to a couple of places. I didn't go far into Siberia, but I did go to a place which is right in front of the Urals. It's sort of, as they call it, the last city of Europe, which I guess it's not going to be the last city of Europe because Russia is no longer part of anything European, as we were told, city of Perm, which is sort of it's an artistic city, but also quite a working city at the same time. And I did not see that support, but when you have a new law and all these incredibly oppressive laws, because before February 24th last year, February 22nd, when Putin announced that he's going to annex the territories completely, the Donetsk and Luhansk republics, then it was a functional autocracy. So it was a functional autocracy, but it had some free speech. There was still some opposition. There were protests.
Novaya Gazeta was still publishing.
Echo Moskvy. There was Dozhd Rain TV, and so Memorial that got closed December 31st. So great gift for the New Year is December 31st, 2021. So all of that really sort of existed. I mean, it wasn't freedom by no means, but also what you discover by being there, and that's for me, that's why it was important, how you think it's totalitarian, but actually it was not. It was first autocracy, then it became authoritarianism. After the 24th, it is a dictatorship. It's not totalitarian yet, because there is still room. People would not be able to travel. People would not be able to have all this sort of Novaya Gazeta still publishes and it still can be accessed online. The Rain TV is still can be accessed online. The Echo Moskvy, the Echo of Moscow, the radio can still exist online. So totalitarianism would suggest or tells us that none of it is going to happen. So we're not even there yet. And so what I witnessed in the last 6 months is that it's like a straitjacket that people are terrified of moving in, because in a straitjacket, the more you move, the tighter it gets you. And so in Perm, in St. Petersburg, in Moscow, and I said I cannot speak for further, it's not that they don't have empathy. They have an absolute horror. It's a despair. It's something that, how did we get there? What was wrong? Where some people think what went wrong. Some people, of course, blame the other, because that's, in propaganda, the first thing you do is blame the other, especially when it pours on you from TV every day. So you blame the other, but it is a society that absolutely doesn't understand what the stability is, what the exit is, and I was giving you these numbers when we spoke before. So 50% of depression drugs, I mean, the sale of depression drugs went 50%. And Russia is a very reading country. It's a cultural country, so they read a lot. Last year, two most sold books. First one is a self-help book, and another one is George Orwell, 1984. So clearly, that's not a society that is not empathetic.
You had a little encounter with George in a bookshop as well.
I did. George has been really quite present there, because another thing is the animal. The third book is the Animal House. So what are we doing is we're treated like the animals once again. So St. Petersburg again, I went to a bookstore in St. Petersburg, the Grand bookstore. A lot of Russian bookstores are grand and with very well equipped with books. And I was actually there in the summer when I arrived, there was still unclear which way we're pivoting. And it was a regular bookstore with normal books at the books that are sold a lot at the entrance, as often are at the bookstore. So in the winter, it was an entirely different story. The books up front at the door would be all this patriotic, I mean, you know, nobody needs to know the titles, but the title is Russia is great. St. Petersburg is the greatest thing that happened to humanity. Moscow is even better. You know, Tsar Vladimir the Great or whatever, and Ivan the Third or Ivan the Terrible, they're the best thing that happened to humanity, and so on. There was a great nationalist, very serious, kind of nasty nationalist, and a writer, actually a talented writer, unfortunately, Zakhar Prilepin. So it's a new biography of Sholokhov. Do you remember Sholokhov? Mikhail Sholokhov, okay, some of you do, but a lot of people don't. I personally kind of forgot about him when I got out of high school in the Soviet Union. So here it is, a new biography of Sholokhov right there in the entrance. So just read all these patriotic things. It's okay, well, I got my anthropological experience. I saw how the country changed in the bookstore from summer to winter. And I was walking out and suddenly I am seeing a very familiar face on a mug right there in the middle of all these patriotic books. And I just startled because it was the face of George Orwell on a mug. And on the other side of the mug, it said, "Let the big brother think that there is tea in this mug." So somebody who was doing this patriotic display decided just to stick George Orwell right in the middle of it. That
brings us to sort of to the heart of the matter in this way. You study propaganda, and every conflict is also a conflict of narratives. And, well, we hear some things about this Russian narrative, and it's pretty confusing. I think that is partly part of the method. The confusion, the putting out of different equivalent statements that partly contradict each other. But how did this narrative, I mean, is this narrative, is that something that people just let wash over them? Are they informed? Or is that something we are beginning to learn Russia is at war with NATO and NATO started it and Russia had to help it, had to help itself and had to defend the Russians in Ukraine or the Russian-speaking Ukrainians and therefore, etc., etc. How plausible is that narrative in Russia?
As Mikhail Gorbachev used to say, in your question there is an answer. So you already just summarized it all for me. For many people it is plausible, because that's what you hear every day. And of course, every time when a European politician says we need to defeat Russia, or we need Russia to disintegrate, or we need Russia to have a strategic weakening. So of course it's then being replayed and reused as propaganda very conveniently and rather successfully to a lot of people. And also, of course, Russia, maybe like Austria, but a lot of countries, for example, I live in the States, in America, it's certainly the case, there are cities And then there are smaller places, and then there are villages. And so, of course, they receive information. No, I mean, they may receive information similarly, but they don't really recycle it for themselves differently. So, for example, in cities, when they say Nairu is out to get us, people have traveled to NATO countries, so they know NATO is not out to get them. In fact, not at all. But if you are in a smaller place or in a village and you've never been abroad, or you've been to Turkey when, you know, once in 5 years you would collect some money to go to Antalya, then it is an entirely, I mean, Turkey is a NATO country, but it's a friendly one too. So it would be an entirely different perception. And that's what the state propaganda targets, really those who, because everybody in the, you know, this 2 million, a million and a half and 2 million that I said left, these are the ones who are not going to believe that NATO is out to get us. And others who cannot leave, because another thing in propaganda is that, and it's not just the Soviet, it's in Nazi Germany it was as well, and in Saddam Hussein's Iraq it was, is that ultimately people tend to think to defend themselves. So they defend themselves for themselves. And instead of thinking and having sleepless nights, for many people, they're saying, oh my God, what are we doing? And a lot of people are having that. But many others would say, I really can, I have to deal with my own children going to the kindergarten, and my parents are sick, and you know, I need a new job. So I'm not going to be overridden with guilt. I'm just going to take this because it's a very good defense mechanism, and that's how it works. But I must say that I am not entirely a believer in the fact that when the state, or you know, the Putin message, the Sergei Lavrov message, the foreign minister, kind of slightly contradictory in their nature, then Prigozhin is there, and then of course Dmitry Medvedev is something else. I actually think that that cacophony is not because they're planning it this way, because Russia is a just generally chaotic and discombobulated country. It's not really kind of evolutionary formula where, as it would be in German case, for example, on page 255, we are going to say this and that.
But I mean, it is for Westerners, for people who didn't grow up with this kind of propaganda, it is stunning when somebody says, the Ukrainians are all Nazis, and you know that country is ruled by a Jewish president who was elected with more than 70% of the vote, something Nazis don't usually do. How is it possible that a story like that can be put out and exist?
The story like that can be put out. I mean, any story. The state can put out any story.
What I want to drive at, I mean, there is this theory that real power is to make you believe what you can't believe.
I mean, yes, there is such a thing as a total lie, right? So when you put the story, but also it's a repetition. When you put forward your story often enough, ultimately, and especially with, you know, when somebody says Russia needs to be defeated, and that is also, it's like, well, I guess maybe they have a point. But then another thing about Russia, and I mean, let's remember, I mean, not we don't have to remember, but let me remind you, it's a very large country. So it's, In many ways, it's easier to control, but it's also much harder to control. But another thing, it's easier to then to push the message from the state, because from the center, when it gets to the outskirts of it, you don't even know what's happening right next to it. For example, you're in Kamchatka, which is bordering Japan. And so whatever it is in Moscow, your message is already distorted quite a bit. So you hear what you want to hear. But another thing about the old Nazis, Russians never believe a full message. I mean, that's another thing. I mean, Russians, there's a double speak, which George Orwell also described, the double speak, double think. I mean, the state will tell you something, but for you, so they are capable of taking something out of it. They're not going to believe the full Nazi thing. But then, on the other hand, they want to defeat us, so there must be something wrong with them. But also it's, and I'm really embarrassed to say that, in fact, we brought up Khrushchev in this, you know, the Russians often used to have, I mean, now probably do again, there was sort of a slightly derogative name for the Ukrainians used, Hakhli. Some Russians, I mean, a lot of Soviets didn't do it, but a lot of Soviets used it. And because it, sometimes you don't even know it's derogative, you just do it. And I remember my mother, she told me when she was a little girl, she used this word. And Khrushchev was completely enraged. He's like, how dare you? This is a nation, this is, you know, their own people of their own. Would you like if they call you Moskal, which is their derogative name for the Russians? And so people don't believe the full message, but they also hark back to their kind of the traditional thinking about this, so there must be something to it. And when you have 11 time zones, I mean, it's the reason I always find so hard to explain Russia, because it's not an evolutionary country. Its problem is not, you're not going from A to B to C to whatever in order. You go from A to Z, from Z to C to K, and so on. And so you can think of all these things all at once. So it's not 100% rational. But if it is some percent in it, nobody's going to believe that Jewish Ukraine, Jewish Zelensky is a Nazi. But there must be something to it. And so that's how they explain and justify it for themselves.
You were asked in an interview, as many people have been asked, could this war have been prevented? And you quoted George Kennan on this. George Kennan, an American former ambassador to Russia, a long-term diplomat who lived many decades in Russia, whose political analysis is conservative, verging on the reactionary, but always very, very clever and informed by a real deep insight. Tell us what George Kennan said about this and how you interpret it.
It's interesting that you say what's conservative verging on the reactionary, because he was quite right about a lot of things. In fact, he was the author of the containment theory, as you remember, 1947, when he wrote a long telegram in Foreign Affairs describing the sources of Soviet conduct and basically designing a formula of preventing wars with the Soviet Union, and in fact worked fine. I am slightly biased about George Kennan. I can tell you why. I was his research assistant. I was his last research assistant. He was 90 years old at Princeton. So I spent 2 years discussing these things with him. And in fact, I was his research assistant exactly at the time when Strobe Talbot, then Undersecretary of State for Eurasian Affairs, in the State Department, they were suggesting the expansion of NATO, and they were writing memos. And of course, they would write memos to George Kennan, because George Kennan spent his whole life analyzing Russia and the Soviet Union. In fact, he began long time, and of course he spoke beautiful Russian. It was pre-revolutionary Russian. And one time, and actually he sometimes insisted on speaking Russian with me, but then he said, well, I can't speak Russian to you. We have to speak English. And I would say, why? And he said, your Russian is so dirty. Because his was beautiful aristocratic, and mine was Soviet Russian. That's all I have. So he shared those documents with me. I still have them, in fact, with his notes saying, what do you think? As if my research assistant opinion in 97 about the NATO enlargement mattered at all. But he was arguing that the NATO enlargement, how no matter how non-aggressive that is, Russians would take as an aggression, and it would influence, even if they don't mean it now, eventually would influence their political behavior, which is exactly what happened. But also George Kennan wrote it before Putin came in, so that he was still talking about regular politicians. So Putin is not a regular politician, and I learned it the hard way, as I said, when I, 30 minutes before the invasion, I argued it couldn't happen, because I still thought of him as a kind of a political being, even if he's a KGB man. But it turned out he's a KGB man bordering on the Tsar, which certainly no political consideration would apply to him. And if George Kennan thought that it would be a problem politically, then if he knew that Putin would be president, he would say, oh my God, don't do it, because that war is going to happen tomorrow.
But what do you do in politics with such an insight? You know, doing this will be perceived as that, but this involves sovereign nations who are free to form associations and have a strong interest, and there are arguments on both sides. So what can grow from such an insight? Yes, one can understand why this impression would arise, but what would that mean translated into politics?
Well, I am not a policy person, which is thank God. I think it's the worst job in the world to prescribe policy. I only analyze politics, so I don't know. But I also can tell you that what George Kennan was right about, I don't know what you're going to do with this information, because that's probably, for policy, it's neither here nor there, although probably need to be recognized maybe, or maybe not, that his understanding of Russia very correctly, even when there's no longer Soviet Union, that Russia under any president, Yeltsin even, would consider itself a great power. And so great powers deserve certain considerations.
But isn't that at the heart of the matter?
Yes, but then you ask me then to prescribe policy, which I absolutely refuse to do.
Well, I'm sort of glad you are, but I mean, this brings up the matter of respect. The insistence of being treated as a great power for a nation with an economy the size of Switzerland, a very large nation with a lot of rusty nukes, it is an impossible ask, isn't it?
If you study Russia, I mean, if you don't study Russia, yes, because that's a very rational argument. But as I said, not A, B, C, but A, Z, K, Y, something else.
Take us into that irrationality. This subtitle of a book about your grandfather, the lost Khrushchev, the subtitle is A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Does this gulag still exist?
Well, apparently. I mean, when I wrote this book, it was sort of a matter of, even my Nabokov book was, maybe George Kennan influence, it was Russia between art and politics. And the book argued that Russia has no politics, it has only art, but then becomes politics. And so when you talk about the rational reaction, even Russian politics is artistic. And I mean, it's not a defense of it, but it's just this grandiose, we're going to do something grandiose and something remarkable. If you look at St. Petersburg, it was built in 10 years, I think, in 17 something or other. In 10 years, and you can see I'm a Muscovite, I don't even know when St. Petersburg was built. In 10 years, and the death toll was stunning, but they got a great thing. So it doesn't matter which way they're going to get it, but it's all this grandiose artist. When Yeltsin said, we're no longer communist, that's it, we're done. We're just going to build capitalism in three quick years. Like, why would you want 3 years? Can we, you know, and the rest of the world spend 300 years achieving? It's like, okay, we're in a hurry, where? Why are we so rushing to do that? And so that's how Russia approaches this. Lenin and the Bolshevik Revolution in 2017, I think we talked about this. You read Marx, it's a philosophy, looks good on paper. You know, they're not revolutions, they're uprisals here and there, they're protests, but it's like, oh, actually no, maybe just a evolutionary way. And the Russian, only Russians would say, looks good, let's do it. And so they do it. Then Putin reads all this Solzhenitsyn, the how to rebuilding Russia, which is a pan-Slavic state. He reads all these philosophers, actually fascist philosophers, Ivan Ilyin and others, which is all philosophies created about Russia on a foreign soil. So it's not even within Russia, but it looks good on paper, I mean, it looks grand on paper. And he suddenly, like Lenin, whom he doesn't like because he doesn't like revolutions, he says, okay, yeah, that sounds good, let's just do it. So it's absolutely irrational. And my book
I heard a lovely idea that one of the reasons that he doesn't like Lenin is that Lenin helped bring a Western ideology to Russia and subjugated Russia, the entirety of Russia, to a Western ideology.
Not exactly. He doesn't like it because he demolished the Tsardom, and you know, that great Tsardom of the great empire, as if Lenin didn't bring a new empire to the fore. But in terms of the gulag of the Russian mind, and so the book is that essentially Russia is a hypothetical culture. It sort of imagines itself so and then lives into the imagination. And so that was written in 2014, published in 2014. So in 2014, It was before Crimea even. And so then I was making a point that Russians don't even need barbed wire to keep them in check. They're just going to build it in their own brain, in their own head, and how wrong I was, because now there is a almost actual barbed wire rising up. So from, in terms of propaganda, once you kind of, the message is there, and the message is there, and then suddenly it just turns into reality.
If you describe this society, what do you see as a possible future from now on? I mean, we are all in a situation where none of us know. Anything can basically happen. We are on a day after an American fighter jet and a Russian fighter jet and an American drone collided in the air. We are days or weeks before a great spring offensive, which will decide a lot on the ground. But of course you can't know the outcomes, but you have a very good idea of how a society in the situation that the Russian society is in would react.
I'm supposed to know the answer, I guess. I don't have a good answer. I guess my answer to this question, which of course we thought about right from the beginning of, February 24th, February 25th, is that my mind hasn't changed. And I think I already then thought that Ukraine will survive and be better than ever, and their identity is now stronger than ever, and the world helps them, and they kind of exceed the expectations that everybody has of them, but Russia is finished. I mean, I'm sure it will, it cannot, 11 time zones do not disappear from the face of the earth. I mean, it's too big of a country, and it's adjacent to Europe, and part of it is in Europe. But how Russia is going to get out of this is a miracle to me, because Putin is not going to give up. He's not winning enough to stop the war, so he is going to continue on, and now, I was talking to some Russian colleagues today, and like, Putin is the war. Now it is his identity. It is his definition. It is his potential to stay in power for as long as he stays in power. So as long as he fights the war, he is in power, unless there's some drastic decisions being made. I mean, there have been this nuclear button keep coming up in a conversation, and then maybe somebody around him would say, you know what, we've waited long enough, just enough. But we don't know that, so we're not going to predict that. So the war goes, the war escalates, because it escalates. We are not really up, all of us are not up for a great ending. So if the war continues, it's bad. If the war somehow stops, it's also bad, because then what is future of Ukraine with the war stopped? I mean, what are the guarantees? What kind of territory Russia would be willing to give
back? But these questions are very important, because whenever I write or speak about this war, I get a whole bunch of emails telling me that I glorify war, that I am an aggressor, and that there must be immediate peace negotiations now. And I got sent a petition where I should have asked that weapons deliveries to Ukraine should be tied to diplomatic progress, whatever the diplomatic progress would
That's
look
Trump's
like.
That's Trump's idea, by the way. Donald Trump just suggested that. So.
Well, that makes the idea all the more appealing.
Well, exactly. That's my point.
What do you say to people in Europe who, for very decent reasons, think that there should be immediate peace and an end to the war at all costs?
When people accuse you of glorifying war, what does it mean? I don't understand. How do you glorify war?
I've been known to say I believe Putin must lose this war, and we must do what it takes to support Ukraine in achieving that.
So I wouldn't say Putin must lose this war just because that gives him ammunition, so I would refrain from this kind of lines. I personally do not glorify war, but I don't see how immediate peace agreement can happen. I just don't see it. Because when, fine, let's say it is. But then so many times we've heard from the Russian side that we are very happy to have a peace agreement, but our conditions must be met. And you должны быть соблюдены. So, okay, if your condition must be met, then every other condition must be met. So everybody have their conditions that must be met. So why your conditions are more important than other conditions? So I just don't see any potential give or take. I mean, if there is a give or take, I get it. I mean, that can be negotiated something. But if the beginning of the process is, we, as the Kremlin often says, we have no preconditions, but our condition must be met. It's like, okay, you have no preconditions, but everybody should do what you say. So I personally do not see how it can happen now without some give or take, like it was in the Cuban Missile Crisis, because everybody has been asking me about that. 1962, October, Khrushchev and Kennedy on the brink. I'm not seeing any of that political, you know, coming back to George Kennan, any of this political negotiation. It is my way or a highway, but I don't really see how that has room for negotiations.
The realists in this debate say any peace process, any process of negotiation can only happen if either one side in the war believes now they have a decisive advantage, or if both sides are so exhausted that they can no longer go on. But few people realize that if there was a peace agreement of some kind, that could only be reached very probably if Western countries would guarantee this peace. Western powers, NATO or some other organization, would guarantee this peace and put troops on the ground. Which would also mean that if Russia or if Putin picked up this war again, the West or NATO would be a direct party to the war. That would change things.
Yes, but at the same time, the way I see it, not predicting it, but it just seems to me going that direction, that the West may be a party to that war soon enough, because as we saw with the more and more weapons delivered, promised. I mean, I know I saw that Poland is already sending fighter jets, and then they will, and then Americans. There's a new suggestion in Congress that F-16s would be sent there, and so if F-16s, and then they could be boots on the ground. So we may not even need to wait. I mean, I'm saying it and I'm horrified, but we may not even need to wait for a second iteration of it, because it's already going, that's already going there. But I think at this point, why I don't see how negotiations possible now is because Putin is not winning enough for him to stop, and Ukraine is not losing enough for it to also stop. And so, and I used it, maybe overused it, in addition to Hollywood, in addition to propaganda, I also teach Hollywood and politics. And so in Hollywood, it's called, in a cowboy movie, it's called Mexican standoff. So it is, in a sense, as a Mexican standoff, which escalates kind of a problem for a Mexican standoff. So there's still other steps, which I personally, I'm not a war expert in any way, I cannot foresee. So I don't have a better answer to this.
Let's come back to Russia itself and to a Russian future and to a future of the Russian society. This is a society that has been bled out brutally, and not only by an estimated now 200,000 soldiers killed or wounded, but more drastically probably, or more dramatically for the country probably, as you said, 1 to 1.5 million people, young people of working age who are probably better educated than the average, who have fled the country and in many countries won't be coming back. That means this country will be quite dramatically weakened in any case. But we have seen with the history of Germany what a dangerous thing it is to humiliate a country in the long term, to isolate a country, to keep a country weak in the long term, a country that simply because of its geographical size or position is an important player. So how is a future there imaginable?
That's you kind of channeling George Kennan, by the way, right now. So incidentally,
my inner George Kennan.
Yeah, you're just totally channeling George Kennan, because he would make a similar argument. Yes, absolutely. I mean, and I actually said 1.5 million to 2 million, because sometimes you hear it 700,000. No, 700,000 only went to Kazakhstan. So this is just the whole many more people there. So absolutely, the IT or the culture. So we were, and I was sort of upset about the certain instances of cancellation of Russian culture elsewhere. But, you know, I have to say that Russia itself, I mean, Putin is, or his people are doing a bang-up job canceling Russian culture within itself. You know, poets left. We even made a kind of a list, so because Putin is P, and so in Russian, like, so the forbidden professions, poets, and then the writers, which is also starts in Russian with a P, and singers, which is also with a P, and press, and so on and so forth. So the P forbids all sorts of professions. Absolutely, and you know, in some comparison, I mean, I actually don't think that history necessarily is a guide. But history punishes very severely for not learning the lessons. And so you could hear in Russia sometimes that it could be that interwar period, the World War I Germany that led ultimately to World War II, possible. And that's why I would say, I mean, I know you say Russia needs to be defeated, but maybe refrain from that language, because Putin then is going to use it for his own propaganda. So maybe, you know, not you, but generally people that be less gleeful about this, because Russians, as I said, you know, when Ukraine is going from what it's going, our heartache is irrelevant, but yet it is relevant within the country. And so, yes, it is possible. But once again, Russian history also showed that it's like a pendulum swing, which I hope we will never come to that part of the pendulum when it is remission oppression. So Stalin, Khrushchev, not that Khrushchev was such a great Democrat, but at least he was a reformer. Gorbachev, great Democrat. So possibly somebody comes in and will try to address the population and say, mea culpa, and we are going to, you know, change behavior, and we are going to try to be better. But then on the part of the West, and I don't know how it can happen, because everybody is so upset with the Russians, that is asking probably too much, much more than it was asked in 91, because Gorbachev already smoothed over a lot of problems from previous years, to say that maybe the West may not jump on the Russian bones that much, because then instead of bringing people into the fold, it would once again create an animosity. But that, my fear is, it's for what has happened, it may be too much to ask to kind of be kinder to Russians. I'm not asking for that, but I'm saying that maybe in terms of policy, if some concessions are not made in something, that it may create that new pre-war, pre-Second World War conditions.
You say somebody might perhaps come to fill that space, and if I interpret you correctly, and please correct me otherwise, it seems that you believe that there's no possible future while Putin is at the helm. There is perhaps a freezing of this conflict, there's perhaps a Korea situation in Europe, but there is no actual peaceful future while Putin is there. But when you say somebody might come, is there anybody you're thinking of? Are there any people in Russian public or political life now that you think have the potential to fill that role?
Totally. A lot of them. But Russia is a Byzantine culture still. All the Byzantine died in 1400s, in the 1400s. You know, Stalin, Khrushchev. Khrushchev would be the last person anybody would imagine would step up and be what he has become. So simply, we don't know. Anybody who we think may be there is probably going to be a wrong person. So a lot of people have been, you know, kind of thrown around as potential. I have some in mind, but I don't think I want to kind of volunteer because I'm
nix
sure.
Nix them.
Right, I think, well, first nix them, but also who knows. But basically, I really don't think we would know.
But I mean, we in the West, from the Western media, we get the impression that there is little or no Russian civil society. There is the isolated light figure of Navalny in prison, but otherwise we hear of hardly anybody who could carry that kind of culture. I think that has more to do with our press and our reporting than with Russian society. But how do you see that?
No, unfortunately it is true. I mean, it's as I said, it's the before February 24th, 22nd, it was a functional authoritarianism. So there was still opposition. I mean, I was in Moscow when Navalny got arrested, and there was still demonstrations for the first month. And actually the reporting was a bit off because it said, well, the police immediately started beating the demonstrators. No, we was there for 2 hours. We were standing there for 2 hours. It was cold, you know, it's Moscow winter. It was cold, and after 2 hours, the police got tired, but also young people who were there got tired of standing. So they just started acting and agitating, and the police decided to respond. And, you know, the police was, I was talking to a policeman myself and said, well, you know, my wife is having dinner, so it really just needs to stop right now. I was like, okay, well, just you get out of here. And I left because I didn't want to be in a fight. But younger people are braver than I am, so they were fighting. But it was also, so all this was potential. It's like if you stayed for longer than 2 hours, maybe there's, but we allow you to speak up, so speak up, but then, you know, about time to go home now. So that's how it was. And that was still, I mean, I said I was there, so in December 31st, 2021, Memorial was still there, this great organization. I was in one of the last panels of it December 15th. So it was all there, and then it began, and then it fell off. And so, yes, there is no civil, there's still remnants of civil society because it's not totalitarianism. For example, I was surprised that nobody in the West reported it, almost nobody. There were protests on February 24th this last February. They were individual protests. People were immediately get arrested. They actually, many came out, about 1,000 people came out in St. Petersburg. I mean, that really took guts. And what's interesting, they went out and, I forgot how many got arrested, over 50. And most of them were released without even a protocol. So basically it's like, okay, just get out. We're done, get out. So there's still something possible, but because it's this straitjacket is tightening and tightening, and I always call it, I mean, I call it the paradox of tyranny, that people tolerate those despots in Russian history because they think they cannot do anything. They cannot change anything. It's going to be, they're going to be demolished. And so they'd rather not move, hoping that they're going to survive. They're not going to survive, but they're still hoping.
That's very interesting because we have all heard now that the political and security situation of the world has effectively changed since the invasion of Ukraine, and that we have to get used to a new situation, which at the same time is an old situation. And that is what I meant, because what particularly shocked me during this war was that the Russian army, with the rapes, the summary executions, the plundering, the thieving, was a Russian army that we've, and also strategically, tactically, throwing lots of bodies at positions. That is a Russian army we know. That's a Russian army we know from the Second World War, from the First World War, from Tsarist times. That is a seemingly a very strong continuity there. How strong do you think are these continuities in Russia, a country that has only ever known, I think, apart from a few months in 1917, some form of dictatorship?
Well, and it is a continuity. I mean, going to the gulag of the Russian mind. I mean, it's the state is always controlling. The state is always relying on security apparatus to keep people in check. We go back to Peter the Great. We spoke about Peter the Great. So he just celebrated, or St. Petersburg just celebrated 350th anniversary of his birth. Window into the West, he was pro-Western, by the way, so that's why I'm not buying that whole argument about Putin and Lenin, because he made the country pro-Western. It's like, oh, Peter the Great was quite pro-Western, but he was a Tsar, so it's all good. And so instead of actually celebrating the window into the West, which is would be contradictory now and kind of almost oxymoronic, because Russia just put all the nails into whatever window and doors it had there, that's all now Iron Curtain, it celebrated the fact that, wait for it, that he was the first one to open a secret chancellery. Secret chancellery is the precursor to KGB. So I use KGB as a collective term for security. So basically, that's what we all celebrate. So Peter the Great had that, and then Lenin had Dzerzhinsky, and then Stalin had Beria and others. And then, I have to say, very proud of Khrushchev, who kind of cut the KGB down to size. Didn't demolish it, but at least made them subordinate to the party. Not that the party was great. Then Gorbachev had a chance to demolish it, didn't demolish it. Yeltsin, in fact, brought Putin in, and in fact, made a holiday celebrating the Den Chekista, the day of the Chekist, the great democratic Yeltsin. Then, of course, Putin comes in, and that becomes the everyday reality. So in some ways, really, Russia is kind of, I studied literature, my gold book on Nabokov was also about Nikolai Gogol, The Dead Souls. And Nabokov was trying, in his literary work, he tried to rewrite every single piece of Russian literature, because Russian literature is circular, and it's always had a bad ending. So Anna Karenina would have, you're very unhappy and you're very unhappy and you die. So Nabokov rewrites it into Ada and saying, no, don't need to be unhappy. It's bullshit, you just be happy. So every single novel that Nabokov wrote is a rewrite of Russian literature in a happy ending. For example, there's a very unknown but great novel called Pnin. It's a rewrite of Chekhov. It's an absolute rewrite of Chekhov, the three sisters, to Moscow, and they never go. So Pnin actually goes. And so so what Nabokov was trying to do is take the circular Russian literature, the dead souls, and move it into the evolutionary evolutionary formula. Didn't last long. And something that Gertrude and I were speaking about yesterday is that there was a great Soviet poet, Osip Mandelstam, a great Soviet poet who died in Stalin's gulag, even though he wrote odes to Stalin, he wrote many, and Stalin never believed he was sincere. He wasn't sincere, and Stalin didn't believe it.
He also wrote one different poem about Stalin.
He wrote, exactly, and ultimately he wrote honestly, we live not feeling the feet under, not feeling the ground under our feet, and our conversations are not heard from 10 steps away. And suddenly, I mean, I grew up reading Mandelstam, and he was always the poet of the past. I'm a Soviet. He was the poet of the past, because we don't experience anything like that anymore when I was growing up. And suddenly, Osip Mandelstam is the most contemporary poet Russia has today. So if you ask if there is a continuity, there is a continuity. We come back to the same circle that was described in Dead Souls in Gogol.
In Dead Souls, you also have the image of the Troika that is hurtling into a future. Many people have identified that with Russia. It's not going in a particular direction, mm-hmm. but it's going at a terrific speed.
But it's not even going to the future. It's going into, in fact, in Gogol, read Gogol, it's going into an oblivion. It's not a future. It's actually Gogol asks, where the hell are you going? And that's how this book ends.
This is how this book ends, and this is, I think, also how our discussion ends. But Nina Khrushcheva, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, and thank you for attentive listening. Goodbye.
Thank you very much.